We come to the 10th presentation, and we're looking at what I have called the Parayana, the way beyond. We came several thousands of years ago to a pivotal watershed that looked back 2,000 years. That pivotal watershed was the time of Jesus. It's not whether one is Christian or Jewish, or as it will turn out, Islamic or Buddhist or anything else. It was a way of gauging time forms that has proved indelible, not only for the last 2,000 years from that time, but going back 2,000 years from that time, from that pivot. But what was interesting is that within three generations of that pivot, because of the resonance of the harmonic set of the time form, it got cast back 2,000 years further, and it, in our time, is cast 2,000 years further into the future. So that the pivot, which was originally a pivot of 4,000 years, quickly became something which now has become 8,000 years, which is a time frame of a refinement of our species. We've talked about how Homo sapiens originated about 200,000 years ago in Africa and remained Homo sapiens for at least 150, maybe 160,000 years. Almost a time immemorial, except when you look at hominid species that we now know go back millions of years, it's actually been a compressed, very short time form for a new species of hominid, Homo sapiens, to occur. And we're one of maybe five or six hominid species that have come and gone for several million years. But about 40,000 years ago, Homo sapiens refined their species by the discovery of a visionary field that yielded a new kind of form, the forms of art. So that when art appears about 40,000 years ago, as far as we know, or maybe led on by 6,000, 7,000, maybe 10,000 years before that. The key to it was that Homo sapiens, for the first time, as a species, left Africa. And when they left Africa, they followed a split trail that a previous hominid species, Homo erectus, had followed 2 million years before. When Homo erectus left Africa, they split by going across a narrow plot of water, which is at the end of the Red Sea, and going from what is today Ethiopia over to what is today Yemen. And then splitting so that they, Homo erectus, went into the Mideast in Europe and went into the Mideast and Asia. And various transformations happened with Homo erectus. One of the major ones was after 1.5 million years came an Asian refinement of Homo erectus, which became what we used to call Peking man. What all this leads up to, without getting overly complicated, is that our particular species, Homo sapiens, some 40,000 years ago, refined in such a way that we had to find a way to continue the species, but in a refined vocabulary. And so sapiens was repeated. And Homo sapiens sapiens is not only wise man, but wise about being wise. That the Homo sapien mind was refined for most of its evolutionary development in a reflective way in order to exist, in order to successfully survive. And the reflective mind looks to the world. It looks to the things and the actions that allow one to continue to live and to be fertile, to continue to pass on that living savvy through the species. The reflective mind became, for a few, transparent about 40,000 years ago, because art is a refinement where the reflective mind ceases to be reflective of just the world, but is transparent so that one is able to enter into visions, into the visionary field. And that visionary field is consciousness, which is distinctly different from a natural cycle and yet complementarity with it. And so the transparent mind, which was very rare, so that there had to be made certain special conditions taken out of nature, where the natural reactions, the natural expectations, the natural cycle was not allowed to simply repeat its habitual, its successful habitual circle, but had moments of hiatus, of interruption, which were supernatural. And for the first time about 40,000 years ago, you find some Homo sapiens had become Homo sapiens sapiens. They had access to the supernatural. And that supernatural, we understand today, is the field of differential consciousness. What happened was that the sense of individuality, which was always the culmination, the maturity of the natural cycle, now had a further, a beyond dimension, which was of consciousness which could transform the natural cycle. Through a supernatural vision, and it probably took 10,000 years for there to be enough Homo sapiens sapiens before they began to successfully plan out the special hiatus situations. And the choice at that time was to go underground to Paleolithic caves and to put art on the walls of the caves. So that as soon as we find Paleolithic art, not only painting but sculpture, we find a quality of the recognition that there is a supernatural transform that can happen to the species to allow for the refinement of species to emerge forth more and more. One of the earliest sculptures, kinds of sculpture that we have, is of a very fat woman, naked woman. And the classic about 30-some thousand years ago found in what is today Germany, she is holding up a crescent, which is both the crescent moon and a crescent horn that could be sounded. And one of the survivals of that is the shofar. Or the warriors blowing their conch shells in India. That horn was not a horn of war or a horn of calling, like it later became, but was a horn of plenty. It was filled with the cornucopia of possibilities. The refinement came about 20,000 years ago, and the all-time great Paleolithic cathedral, temple, is Lascaux, discovered in 1940. And in Lascaux, we have, for the first time, a refinement of a pattern that first occurred some 15,000 years before then. The first caves that had that kind of a transform of species by making sure that there was a dramatic sequence of initiation, as we would say, of being taken into a supernatural hiatus from the natural cycle underground and being guided through, being shown a sequence of peeling off the vestiges of the natural responses and introducing those who were being taken through to a supernatural creativity where progressively they experienced more and more an interior space that was transparent from a higher self, as we would say, from a prismatic self that does not reflect so much. It can reflect, but it can equally contemplate. The bridge between a reflection and a contemplation is a meditation. A meditation is the equilibrium of a reflection and its complementary, a contemplation brought together. And a meditation allows for one to have the horizon of equanimity. That horizon of equanimity is the clarity through which one now can have a double seeing. One can see reflectively the world, but one can see allegorically the beyond the world. And one of the great developments in Jesus' time was the application of an allegorical twin-mindedness to reading, to symbolic language that would allow one to read in two ways at once. One could read reflectively, this is about people doing these things with these sets of actions in this world, but it also can have another meaning, and that other meaning can be dovetailed together. It took 1,000 years only for that pair of allegorical tuned meanings to pair again so that one had four. And when one looks at the great master of this quaternary allegorical, one is reading Dante. The Divine Comedy can be read in four different modes, or in the four different modes all at the same time, which makes the reading then a quintessential conscious realization. And that the quintessential conscious realization, when one can read four different ways together, that fifth way is not just a braiding of the four, but introduces a way of organizing the other four with the fifth to make a new way to handle, a new way to grasp, a new way to display, a new way to make the adjustments And so the hand, again, becomes the cutting edge of the mind. The person who originated that phrase was Jacob Bronowski in his Ascent of Man series a couple of decades ago. The hand is the cutting edge of the mind. And there is such a thing, then, not only of the allegorical mind being able to read two ways at once, reflectively and contemplatively, but that can pair again so that one can read historically and one can read mythically. So the expansion comes because one has enlarged the horizon of equanimity to a larger set. The first set, one can read in vision, or one can read in symbols. The symbols being the reflective integral, and the vision being the differential conscious. 1,000 years later, it was possible to go back from the symbol to the myth, to the mythic, and forward from the vision to the art. What is being presented here is a third level of expansion. From someone like Philo of Alexandria, 0 AD, to Dante, about 1200 AD, to my presentations at the beginning of the 21st century, now going all the way back before symbols, before myth, to nature, and going forward, not just with vision and art and history, but onto science. So that the refinement that is being offered here is a refinement comparable to the refinement of species of Homo sapiens to Homo sapiens sapiens, the Latin style of denoting a species. I keep and say that the refinement this time is Homo sapiens stellaris. Not just wise man or wise about being wise, but being star wisdom wise. So that our habitability is no longer some area, a valley, or a whole series of river valleys, or even a whole continent, or even a whole planet, but the entire star system, which opens up for us then that the adventure is an adventure that goes to other star systems, and that those other star systems are rather staggeringly, kaleidoscopically arrayed. The current mythology of aliens, mostly being grays, or some being like us, is pathetically pre-kindergarten. There are trillions of civilizations. And so it is a question of acclimating ourselves, recalibrating ourselves to a fuller spectrum. And that fuller spectrum I call the parayana. I've been blessed to have had the friendship and companionship for years and decades on of many Homo sapiens stellaris persons who helped me to mature. And I've been teaching on the university level for almost 50 years. One of the things I would like to deliver to you before we take a break is an experience of how a science fiction story opens up the parayana. This one, and I'll talk about after the break how it came to be written, this one I wrote in 1985, and it's called Theodore in Winter. And I'll talk about who Theodore was other than the story, but allow me to give you the story. Theodore in Winter, from the summer solstice of 1985. The station was sophisticated. It had to be. This was the only scientific project on the planet. All that work collecting, analyzing, synthesizing, sure, the station was good. But just to watch over things, Theodore was placed on board. Theodore had everything an android desired. Normally, this statement reads the other way. Theodore was everything man desired, but you never would put it so colloquially after watching Theodore work. And he was made specifically, strategically, to think in new ways. Creative programming or something. They had names and designations at the place where Theodore was assembled deep in 21st century Los Angeles, some hidden ravine and deserted hills of a secret canyon. But those names and designations are still top security, in fact, more now than ever. No background on the station whatsoever was released, which is also might be just as well. On the planet, radioactive methane crystals were the natural storm element, that is, along with the 300 kilometer per hour winds. And the jagged surface blasted for days on end, granulated stuff into sharp dust, deadly to life forms, all life forms. Only the station and the android were synthesizing any activity. The rest of the planet was lifeless. Oh yes, we all thought that. The Los Angeles firm in charge of the mining exploration, the government officials, everybody here in emergency procedures, there was not one person in EP who predicted trouble. I mean, the eventuality. We've just got to keep this thing within protocol language. According to Theodore's tapes, he recorded the entire sequence. Maybe this was the beginning of the problem. He forgot nothing. Anyway, Theodore was sitting in the North Observation Dome, 16 years into the project, when the warning lights signaled intruder somewhere in the eastern vents, ground level zero. Theodore had never seen the intruder signal light up, except in some Canoga Park test routine way back when. So naturally, well, logically, he sealed off the entire eastern quadrant. The video probes showed nothing, and the heat sensors were nominal. But the progression of intruder signals definitely showed something lurking now inside the vents near the folding and gathering disks. All right, Theodore reasoned, it's cold-blooded as hell. The tapes clearly show this distinct phrasing. Unsatisfied with the video probes, Theodore got up and walked towards the armament kiosk on level 4. He had to go there physically because there was no circuitry for the event. No matter, thought Theodore, I'll go in person. In person is audible on the tape emulsion matrix despite efforts in some security scan to erase this to a blip. Once armed, Theodore decided to have a look-see for himself. Remarkable vocabulary entry, really showing here already some primordial influence on his multifaceted code emplacement or something. Of course, there were no lights in the F&G area, never needed. Some group caught it for sure over this one. But Theodore brightened his eyes in the sweet beams of laser energy modified by the multifaceted code translators into a sort of rainbow hue swept in two coordinated parallel beams through the abject darkness, our adjective. The illumination disclosed the long corridor. The wall units, the floor dusty and moist, Theodore noticed a possible leak, a defective seal perhaps, the snake-like ceiling apparatus humming softly, the light disappearing into the darkness, disappearing into the darkness, down the tubes, abyss. All three entries are a montage at this point, along with some very peculiar waveform indentations which read out in no computer language known. Theodore had arrived at the eastern vents, standing gun ready in the darkness, his eyes sweeping the scene, vibrant with soft thrumming, of support coils. He was quite alone, he deduced, and apparently that bothered him, his word. Remaining motionless for half an hour, the android replayed all his tapes looking for analytical clues. The station was now recording the path of something moving forward, yes, toward the integration centers in the middle, level 6. There, that something must be identified, thought Theodore, running now in the darkness, identified. The entry was triple asterisks, and a whole new logical unit of inquiry was begun. Because of the symbiotic relationship between android and station, all of that file was relayed to the station. Theodore kept only a tactical matrix open for himself. Is this a clue? He was still running in the darkness on level 6 when the realization managed to reach red light awareness. The lights were off all over the station. Theodore tapered off his gallop to a casual jog and then stopped, waiting again in the darkness. How can the lights be off? True, there were no fixtures near the F&Gs, but here was the main access corridor outside the integration modules. He turned his head until his beam showed a darkened bubble overhead 10 feet off. Out. He turned his head 180 degrees and 20 feet down the other way. Out. Turning to a wall panel, Theodore placed his palm in the magnetic glove opening, keying into the circuitry. A pleasant flow indicated power, but still no lights. He turned his palm 90 degrees, no flow. So the helium atmosphere was off. His mind checked his nexial pivots and found them down 15%. Trouble. He turned his palm left 180 degrees. Suddenly, his eye beams flared, circuits stressed instantly, instinctively. Theodore's defensive web closed his hand into a fist, neutralizing the contact. His fist slipped out of the dark wall glove into a rapidly pulsing flare of his laser beam. Shock had continued to surge, splayed palm circuits. Theodore dutifully recorded, "I'm trembling." Then the comparison feeds coalesced suddenly, and Theodore knew what he was up against. "No magnetic vampire is going to suck my circuits," shouted Theodore. "We know," he shouted out loud, to the darkened machine silence, because we have both the audio wave impression all along that corridor and even on sections of the one above it, plus the faint parallels close to them indicating an echo. To get an echo on 3 acres of instrumentation, Theodore had been rather emphatic. Or, as circumspect Jake in Psionics put it in the margin of a report, desperate. Theodore had crossed a line. His circuitry had been programmed to fit the station. Now the station was infiltrated, sick. Something had to be done to restore order. Searching his memory disks, he recognized the need to be prepared while thinking out his strategy, his approach. So he found himself going back to the armament kiosk on level 4. On the way, his logic keeping pace with his long, quick strides, the machinery flashing by caught his peripheral attention. This clue, associative and subtle, sparked his integral core. In sympathy, his memory began running the recent events. His mind fanned out, amplifying all context. "Well, now to the game of parentheses," muttered Theodore out loud. Each set of sequences were now arranged target-like, one within another. Each matrix was a montage of cyclical permutations and counterstack. Theodore, in this procedure, built up a background, inventive, a web of intrigue, it turns out, from later developments. As he was gathering possible tools, weapons, Theodore found he had no place to put all these things. On an associative sidetrack bypass, he received the image for this eventuality. Thus he laid out a long belt of ribbing on the floor, fastened tools and weapons along its length. Next, this was gathered up, arms spread wide, looped over his head, onto his left shoulder, let drape, and finally closed with a press-on series of catches, secure. Just to be extra careful, Theodore reached for the knife he used to fashion the belt. Now he turned to go, but happened to see his reflection in a polished bulkhead. There he was, 7 feet, fit, handsome, ready, with a bandolier across his chest and knife at the ready, his eyes pearled. He recognized a hidden iconography, an image of icons, something not out front in the programming. This was a content between the lines, nuances, and image recognition from some deeper source. He flashed on it. The mind of the programmer. This was a previously hidden image. Bandolier. As he repeated the word aloud, he checked his vocabulary. Not there. It had occurred with the icon image. They came up together. More words were now within reach. Guerrilla fighter. Freedom struggle. Theodore's lasers were opalescent. Now we'll show them, he said. We, he thought, whoa, the programmers were with him all the way. No problem. Eventually, such an emergency had been foreseen. They really knew their stuff, these patriarchs, these men, heroes, forebearers. Theodore began moving out. Heroes, heroes. The new word sung out loud in tune with the humming snake coils, winning all along the corridor ceiling, punctuating a cyclic drone like some lead singer. Lead singer. Heroes. Guerrilla fighter. Freedom struggle. Theodore put more application on the code lines, feeding Chip's super energy and vectoring purpose to hell with conclusive roles. The station was going to be saved. This is an emergency, shouted Theodore in triumphant simulation. Moving quickly, he found his way back to the original intrusion, the eastern vents. Outside, a storm was brewing. Tiny frozen methane drops crystallized, pulverized. They were being driven as weird sleet against the exterior. This minute hail caused a white sound hush effect there in the darkness. The android must have been playing back for himself older, more primordial programs. Matrix set after disk integration set. Even the earliest multifacetic code banks had probably been reviewed in utter darkness. No visuals go with this part of the record. Instead, the audio has this weird tapestry of the storm's hiss and the station's hum. 4 or 5 hours of this. Then he must have discerned a discrepancy. A dull red glow flickered on. Intruder. By his remote connections, Theodore clocked the delay. 2 minutes until the intruder alert was flashed in the north observation dome. But it never came on in the south observation dome, despite waiting 10 minutes more. In fact, only 2 spots showed the warning, here and there. The records had revealed this pattern before. Limited response was theoretically impossible. Something basic was wrong. Theodore shifted his knife to point out in the other direction of the dark corridor. He was now scouting. The section of warning signals was evidently meant for him to see. It only concerned the android. That is, the android and these 2 points in the station. Weird. Weird, said Theodore softly. As before, the station's alert system began indicating the ingress of something. Theodore watched the unmolested dust and moisture down an entire quarter mile of original corridor. His telescopic vision followed the warning lights as they came back on. Again, the video synchronized now to his multifaceted eyes showed the movements towards Level 6 Integration Center. Identified, identified, murmured Theodore, loud, alone. There was nothing there except in the station's own circuitry. Theodore turned to face the nearest vent. Its 30-yard height dwarfed him. Moving carefully forward, he pushed on the safety release. The lowest panel swung out. A mild breeze blew from the airlock beyond. Another release and the storm blasted in. Theodore watched the dark intruder dials. Crystal methane sleet snowed through the airlock into the station, the methane discoloring slightly as it piled in, beginning to melt dirty brown. No light, no intruder. It wasn't physical. Item. Magnetic vampire, said the android aloud in cool, even tones. He shut both releases. The gas pressure squealed twice, then silence. No, the station still hummed. Then Theodore heard it. He jumped up, knife ready. Eyes brightened down the corridor. A shriek echoed in the elevator at the very far end. Lord save us, muttered Theodore. Where that came from, he didn't know. Some nuance behind, some code lines embedded peripherally in a lost ravine in Los Angeles long ago. The elevator shaft became bioluminate. Dimly, the pattern of the station's humming changed. Modulating the imagery, whatever it was now on its way back confidently. No intruder signals now, and no doubt it had integrated the station itself, infected it, and coming fast. If it had got the station, it could get him. No defense, except Theodore hit both releases and dove through the airlock headfirst. The discontinuity behind wailed eerily close into the storm, plunged the armed android running too fast to hear the releases pop back, sealing the vent behind. Well, emergency procedures team arrived years later on standard recon to find Theodore still camped out in the storm. He had rigged a lean-to over himself and even a portable atomic heater unit before him like an eternal campfire. Of course, we were surprised to see the knife held out towards the station still and shocked to see his face. You would swear that he was unshaven, you know, like his dour expression sort of got to you. To top it off, he asked if we had a light. Standing in floodlit dark, we didn't get that until somebody noticed something rolled up and stuck into his microphone mouthpiece. It was evidently a simulated cigar. We assured Theodore that androids didn't smoke. But he really did not respond. All this time staring in the station's direction. After several hours of conversation, the bandolier was surrendered. And finally, the phony cigar. The knife we let him keep until deactivation way back home in Los Angeles. It kind of fit the scene anyway. The reports were long and complex, apparently over some 16 years. The android and the station had developed apart. Yes, even complex machines can't stay married forever. Whoever would have known this before? They do grow apart. The station had developed a revulsion for the android. Arrogant was one odd entry early on in its assessment. Over the long, cold years, the station had actually followed its prime directive and had sympathized more and more with the planet. They grew in an odd symbiosis. Theodore was increasingly an alien. The reasoning was strangely sound, too, since the station was so automatic, really near perfect in its functioning, the android keeper had less and less to do. Eventually, it seems he took to analyzing himself, his own circuits, and training. This further provoked the station into considering him vain or excessive. finally, as it was entered, exclusionary. The way the station figured it, and this was pretty close to the issue, theater was verging on a tautological short circuit. Well, the station was not at all ready to follow that. In fact, with the planet as a closer context, friend entered on the station's main integrator, it hit upon the intruder ruse as a plan to maneuver the android outside. Once so, he would be locked out for good. And thus it was. Actually, the station's main banks did show something like surprise or even credulity to discover us. Our coming back, I mean, the fact that the universe contained us was a rude awakening. The empathy with the planet had blurred all human origins. This was the final point in our conclusion, that even though Theodore was the first android to develop a phobia, the first machine to flip out, the station was, more amazingly, the first machine to go native. Let's take a break.